Rachel Cochrane. I'm at Hartlepool Central Library, where I've been working with the writing group here to develop creative work and produce a podcast as part of the Crossing the Tees Book Festival 2015.
It runs from the 3rd to the 20th of June in venues across the region. All the details of times and prices and how to book are available at www.crossingthetees.org or pick up a brochure from your local library.
Leaving Hartlepool, written and read by Pauline Long. My grandmother, Sarah Jane, worked with her mother as a fishwife in Hartlepool. They lived at the sea wall, then moved to a flat nearby, before crossing the county boundary into East Durham. Sarah held the homemade quilt closely to her, desperately trying to keep out the cold sea air's salty tang which seeped through the worn window frame. Gratefully, she felt her little sister, Lily, snuggling into her back, keeping them both warm. The boats, a few hundred yards away at the quay, were creaking. How the wind must be lifting. The bedroom's dark walls shifted and quaked as she peered from under the covers, eyes slitted. Suddenly too warm, she gasped for air, shifting away from Lily. Wood banged, and the salt drifted and swirled and clung. She dragged herself to the surface, out of the waters of her dreams. They clung damply to her. She was sluggish, warm. Lily coughed. That's not right, Sarah thought. That's not right. There were no bells. When the boats heaved themselves about the water tops, bells hanging from the rigging would clang. There were no bells. They hadn't lived at the seawall since Dad died. He'd fallen, slipped and drowned in surging cargo, drowned out of the water in the hold of a ship. The quilt was making her hot and sticky. It didn't smell right. Yowling joined the wooden creaks and crackles. She'd blown out the candle when she and Lily had snuggled into bed. Her eyes searched the darkened room. She put her feet on the floorboards. They were warm. Their chill should have startled her awake. The air wasn't coming from the windows. It was rising, pushing up through the floorboards. The yowling grew. At last she saw. The cat, usually curled up on the cushion of the rocking chair, was standing, legs pounding on the chair seat, hair standing on end. In its agitation, it had the chair tilting violently, the wooden rockers hammering a beat against the wooden floorboards. "Mam! Mam! The flat's on fire! Wake up! Wake up!" Heat surged from below. "Lads! Lads! Up! Up!" Mam was yelling and running. She hauled at the window, pushing it open. "Alec, the mattress! Shove it out, man!" Strong anyway and powerful in her fear, Sarah's mother pushed Lily, still gaping and groggy, off the bed, dragging the mattress from under her. The two boys were in the room, bedraggled, pulling braces over shirts they'd had no time to tuck in. They pushed their mother out of the way, daring in their urgency. Alec looked at Jack. "Laura's down, man." Alec climbed over the windowsill, letting himself down until he was holding the frame. Jack held his brother's wrists and lowered him further until he dropped, landing on the mattress. Mam was running round the kitchen, grabbing food, utensils, her Bible, bag and purse, pushing them into the middle of a quilt, fastening the corners, dropping it on the floor by the window. She could gather more belongings until the last of the bairns was out. Sarah pushed Lily into coat and hat, gathered shoes together with one hand, yanked Lily to the window with the other. She shoved her at Jack, hurled pairs of shoes into the street before prodding him. "Drop her to him! Drop her now!" Lily squalled until Sarah threw the cat into her arms. Then she went. Sarah and Mam locked eyes. Who would go next? "You, Mam, you go. I'm skinny. They'll catch me easy. Lily's crying." Mam nodded, dragging sheets filled with their few clothes to the window. "Throw them out, Jack. We'll need them." Coughing and spluttering now, she pummeled him, ignoring his doubt. Heat was building under their feet. They danced as if on hot sand. Every bit they could save was precious. They had so little. Sarah grabbed a pillow, thin inside its cotton case, and shoved her school books in. Mum was over the sill now, and Sarah knew Alec would be ready to catch her, Lily screaming and clinging to his legs. "Go, Jack, I need you to catch us." She took one last look round. The pram. The pram was for filling with fish and taking them on the train up the coast, leaving Teesside and going up into East Durham, visiting one pit village after another. Blackhall, Hawden, Easington, Shotton, never having to go right to Durham, selling fish until they'd gone, then coming home again. Sarah, determined, toes flinching from the floorboards, wheeled it over. It was suddenly huge and cumbersome. She hauled, pushed and shoved it through the window opening, reminded of clumsily lugging loaded fish-filled baskets from ship to shore. "Catch it! I'm coming next!" The room was smouldering now, her feet burning, lungs heaving, air-starved, fearful, exhausted. She jumped onto the windowsill, swung herself round, took one last look into the thick grey and white smoke and dropped into her brother's arms. Head back over Alec's arm, Sarah, guessing Jack had Lily and Mam was gathering their belongings in and around the pram, heard Mam's pronouncement. "That's bloody it! Hartlepool's had it. It's taken me man and me home. We're off." Sarah knew they'd all be getting on the train that morning and going up the coast. They'd take the pram filled with goods and chattels, not fish, and they wouldn't be coming back.
Asylum, written and read by Roberta Thompson. The four girls alighted from the coach. Looking at the grey darkening sky, Aisha pulled the coat she had been given tightly around her thin shoulders. The man, Tanver, who had been assigned to show them to their new home, barely spoke and communicated mainly by gesturing for them to follow as he herded them towards a door leading into a dark, musty-smelling stairway and up to a large room. The room was sparsely furnished with battered furniture. A dusty-smelling, low-watt ceiling light revealed the drabness of the room. The girls who had met for the first time in the coach were of a similar age and race. Two of them spoke the same language, but Aisha and the other girl did not understand them or each other. Tanver spoke in English, which Aisha understood, for she had attended the church school in her village. He quickly explained the housekeeping, heating, kitchen equipment, and what to do in case of emergency, and left as soon as possible, with the air of a man who had completed his allotted task. The refugees looked around the room and at each other with large, sad eyes. Aisha took control and gesticulated that the girls who shared a language should share a room, and she and the other girl have the remaining one. Exhausted by the gruelling journey, they lay down, each one with her own thoughts, fears and memories, and slept. Awakened by daylight, Aisha rose quietly and, looking at the view from the grime-smeared window, saw a row of run-down shops and flats. Her eyes took in the towers and chimneys of a chemical plant discharging poison into the grey skies of Teesside. She shivered and, hugging herself tightly, moved from the window. Thoughts of the hot, dusty ground of her homeland saw her eyes fill with unshed tears of sadness, and the shivering increased. Memories of the day the soldiers had come to her village and rounded up the congregation in the Pentecostal church caused her tears to spill over, and she sobbed great shuddering sobs. The men and boys had been led into the bush at gunpoint. She had never seen her father and brother again. The women and girls had been given to the soldiers, irrespective of their age. Aisha was 15. Her mother had died when she was 10. She allowed herself the luxury of crying, as for so long she had adopted the survival strategy of closing her mind and numbing her senses. She cried out loud, "I was a good girl. I went to church. Why did he let these things happen?" She cried at being all alone in the world and in a strange land. As though in answer to the cries of anguish, she felt, for the very first time, the baby move inside her. She smiled in wonder at the sensation and, drying the tears, whispered to her child, "I'll always love and protect you. You are mine and I am yours." It did not matter which soldier had caused the pregnancy, the baby was hers and hers alone, sent from heaven to be her salvation. Good, born out of evil. Gazing once more at Grangetown, now through tears of happiness, the picture seemed strangely illuminated. What lay before her was her own Garden of Eden. At last, she was safe. With these thoughts, she entered the kitchen to prepare breakfast for the sleeping girls, who she knew had suffered like her and would need the help and kindness of others to start the healing process.
Crossing the T's, the Summer of 69, written and read by Ethel Sturman. In the summer of 69, I left my local grammar school and began my first real adventure into the world of work. I started my first job as a trainee metallurgical chemist at British Steel. "Nothing too remarkable about that," I hear you say, and if it were 2015, then I would probably agree with you. But it wasn't 2015. It was 1969, when girls who left school at 16 were expected to work in factories and shops or were trained as hairdressers. They certainly didn't work alongside and receive the same training as boys the same age. My parents may have been a bit surprised when I said I wanted to train as a chemist, but they knew I preferred the interesting to the conventional. My grades were pretty good across the board, but I had always had a fascination with the sciences. I might have taken a position with the coal board, but instead I accepted an offer from British Steel. And so it was on August the 14th, 1969, I and two other lucky ladies began training along with 12 male school leavers. We were the first girls ever to do so, although then we did not realise we were forging a path for equality in a male-dominated workplace. My stomach was filled with butterflies on that first morning. The bus journeys took a good 40 minutes and thoughts whirled in my head as to what was to come. We had to dress for the job. Trousers only, no skirts, white lab coats and steel-toed shoes. We must have looked a right sight. From the beginning, Sharon, Isabel and myself were the best of friends. We quickly became known as the Three Musketeers and could stand our ground against anything the boys could throw at us. The first 12 weeks were to be spent at the Malleable Works in Stockton doing workshop training. Lathe turning, welding, blacksmithing were the order of the day. Everything we needed to know to understand steel processes and what we were asking of people when we asked for samples for analysis. It was amazing how quickly we learnt these strange new skills, and I was as proud as punch the day I appeared on the 6 o'clock ITV news showing my skills on a lathe. To this day, I still have the metal poker I made. There were lots of boys there, training in a variety of trades as well as chemists. Some were engineers, others were boilermakers, and they came from all over the Teesside area. Although it was hard work, and it was difficult getting up in time to catch the 6 o'clock bus, and then not getting home until after six on a night, I loved every minute of it, especially the lunchtime darts matches. The next phase of training took place at the Northworks, Seaton Carew. It was like stepping back into Victorian times. Everywhere was dirty and noisy as the coal wagons tipped their loads and the blast furnaces belched out sulphurous fumes. Our laboratories merged into the industrial landscape, blackened bricks eaten away by acid rain and sea salt, tall windows coated with muck, straining the sunlight so that electric lights constantly burned within. Inside, the building was divided into a rabbit warren of smaller rooms. The biggest of these was the main lab, where we practiced chemical analysis of the diverse ingredients needed to make iron and steel, as well as the final testing of the metals. Other rooms allowed for sample preparation, drying ovens for coal analysis, macro photography, and a dark room. The tiniest room in the building was allocated to the girls for our restroom. Here we had a small table and chairs, a kettle, and an electric fire. Luxury indeed. At least on winter mornings when we had trekked through freezing snow and ice, that two-bar electric fire certainly felt luxurious. Add to that the still warm tea cakes collected by Isabel on her way past the bakery and toasted on that same fire. No wonder the boys were jealous. Within 6 months, we were considered proficient enough to make the transition to the main laboratories in the Southworks on Stockton Road, and our work lives would start in earnest. Training would continue, our knowledge and skills would increase, but some of the group would go off to work elsewhere, and the camaraderie we shared would be lessened by their leaving. We had crossed the T's together, and the next stage of our journey was about to begin.
This podcast was sponsored by the Four Library Services and Arts Council England.